From the KTOO Newsroom, I'm Pablo Araspeña with your state and local news update. An invasive fungus is threatening Alaska's frogs, toads, newts, and salamanders, Claire Strempel reports for Alaska's Energy Desk.
The fungus's full Latin name,
Batrachochytrium dendrobatidis, or botitis,
is such a mouthful that scientists call it BD, or chytrid. That was Reese Brand Phillips, who works for the National Forest Service and leads the Threatened and Endangered Species Program in the state. He says it's a threat to all six of Alaska's amphibian species. So he's calling for a multi-agency working group to get ahead of the fungus before it's too late.
We know that it has had devastating impacts elsewhere, so we want to get a handle on this before we see impacts in Alaska.
It's not always lethal, but the fungus has decimated frog populations around the world and is thought to be responsible for up to 90 extinctions. Phillips says researchers aren't sure how it got to Alaska, but it has been observed here since the year 2000. Researchers have traced chytrid from the Kenai Peninsula to Prince of Wales Island. It's not everywhere. There's no evidence of the fungus on Douglas or Admiralty Islands near Juneau, but it's turned up in Yakutat, Cordova, Haines, and Skagway. And while scientists know the fungus is widespread, they don't yet have a sense of its impact on the frog populations in the state. Part of the reason for that is they don't know how many amphibians there are.
There's some anecdotal evidence that frogs used to be more abundant than they are now, but we can't definitively say that BD did that. And so that's one of the challenges that we have right now is trying to gather that baseline data to really try to ascertain where we're at.
Phillips says the fungus thrives in warm temperatures, about 60 to 70 degrees Fahrenheit. That means climate change could increase its prevalence in the state.
If things warm in Alaska like we anticipate, what that's going to probably do is it's going to expand the areas northward where BD can survive. And so we can anticipate that we might have BD in areas where we don't have it now.
That could be hard on amphibians. Humans don't get BD, and predators don't either. It only affects freshwater zones. Phillips says fieldwork in Alaska this summer will give the agency a better sense of where the virus is and point to how it might be contained. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Claire Strempel.
In other news, tiny homes have gained traction in recent years as an affordable housing alternative, but building them legally poses challenges in many communities. Sitka was one of the first cities in the country to introduce a set of tiny home-friendly code changes last year. But as KCAW's Aaron McKinstry reports, a year after passing the groundbreaking ordinance, no one is building them.
A few years back, Stephanie Cruz and her husband decided they were sick of renting. They moved around a lot for Cruz's job, so buying a house wasn't a great option. Besides, with Southeast Alaska's high rental rates, they weren't saving enough for a down payment. They looked at manufactured homes and RVs, but ultimately settled on a tiny house on wheels.
Tiny house holds its value a lot better than an RV because it's built with more traditional construction materials that are meant to withstand the weather. And then also, you know, they're whimsical and fun.
With beige siding and a blue metal roof, the roughly 170-square-foot house looks like a mini single-family home. Cruz and her husband took out an RV loan and paid a company in British Columbia $40,000 to build it. They moved it to Juneau on the ferry. When Cruz's job brought her to Sitka, the tiny house came with them. Even with their loan payment and the cost to rent a spot at a local RV park, Cruz says they were paying a couple $100 less a month than if they were renting.
I think the kind of ruling concept for people who do small homes or tiny homes is a small house for a big life. If you can reduce your housing expenses and, you know, kind of minimize that in your life, but still make it a pleasant place to be, then that gives you the ability to kind of put your funding towards the things that you are really passionate about in your life.
For Cruz and her husband, that meant a trip to Japan and saving to buy a regular house. And when they sold the tiny house and left Sitka for the Pacific Northwest, that's exactly what they did.
I think it's a really great stepping stone to home ownership like it was for us.
But even though rent in Sitka is high and home ownership can be cost prohibitive, people in Sitka aren't following in Cruz's footsteps. That's despite changes to the city's building and zoning codes a little over a year ago to make tiny homes easier to build. Pat Swadeen is Sitka's building official.
There's definitely been a few individuals who have been interested in it. We've also had actually a couple of companies think about maybe trying to go that route. Thus far, we haven't had anybody actually begin that process of permitting and constructing a tiny home.
Even before the changes, Sitka didn't have a minimum house size, but meeting building standards for small structures was a challenge. So Sitka adopted a set of international regulations to make it easier to build houses under 400 square feet, allowing for things like ladders and lower ceilings. It also addressed a legal gray area for tiny homes on wheels. Before last March, Sitka considered them RVs, like almost any other place in the country. And legally, you can't live in an RV year-round in Sitka. Now, they have their own designation. They're allowed in trailer courts, and there are some zones where they can be placed on lots by themselves with Planning Commission approval. But there are still barriers, like the cost of construction, Swadeen says.
Per square foot, a tiny home isn't really super affordable. You know, since it's small, it's not like the cost of building a 2,500 square foot house. But you still need to have cooking appliances. You still need to have heating appliances. You still need to have bathing facilities and a toilet and things like that.
Financing and land availability are also big hurdles. Jennifer Younger bought Cruz's tiny home as an affordable option for her son. Much like Cruz, it allowed him to save money to buy his own house. Now they're looking to sell. But Younger says land availability has stopped a lot of potential buyers.
We've had several people very interested and check it out, and it's a beautifully built, you know, little home, but people just don't have property to put it on.
Even though tiny homes haven't taken off, Sitka Conservation Society's Chandler O'Connell isn't discouraged. SCS partnered with a Sitka High School construction class to build their own tiny house a few years ago. Their efforts to sell it sparked a community conversation, which contributed to the eventual code changes.
And I think our learning from past code changes is it takes a while for that information to get out there. It takes a while for people to understand the implications and think about how they want to implement that in their own building decisions. But I'm excited to see how it can shape Sitka's housing market over the next few years.
She says she sees tiny homes as one affordable housing option of many. They won't work for everyone, but it's about getting more tools in Sitka's housing tool belt. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Erin McKinstry.
About half of Alaskans who responded to an online survey in March from the State Health Department said they had not gotten a COVID-19 vaccine yet or booked an appointment. And about half of that unvaccinated group said they probably or definitely won't get vaccinated. The health department released those survey results and others on Thursday. Epidemiologist Sarah Aho said the department wants to learn more about why some Alaskans haven't gotten a vaccine yet and what questions they may have.
There's so many topics to talk about with COVID vaccines that we really want to make sure we are focusing on what we're hearing from the community.
The survey involved just over 1,200 Alaskans, and it narrowed in on one group who were unvaccinated but said they were open to learning more about the vaccine. Alaska Chief Medical Officer and Dr. Ann Zink says about a quarter of them said they had not gotten a COVID-19 vaccine yet because of the concerns about the safety or side effects.
It's really easy to overestimate the side effects or the risk of something new versus underestimate the risk of something we do all the time, like getting in the car.
Another 25% said they don't think COVID is that serious, but Zink pointed to a huge spike in cases in Fairbanks encountered.
So we have a really powerful tool against this virus, but unfortunately, we are still seeing even very young people get very sick and die. We've had two people in their 20s in the last couple of weeks die from COVID-19.
Less common answers included concerns that the vaccine was rushed or conspiracy theories about it. And according to the survey results, for about three quarters of the hesitant Alaskans, their most trusted sources of information about COVID-19 were their family and friends. They trusted their employers the least. State health officials said they'll use the survey information to help inform how they communicate about the vaccine. And the Chief Justice of the Alaska Supreme Court says the court system did not receive a ransom demand or any direct message from those involved in a cybersecurity attack last week that resulted in the system disconnecting its online service. The court system said Saturday that it had disconnected online services to remove malware from its servers. For more on this story, go to ktoo.org. This is KTOO News.